Blog Talk Radio. Welcome to Snap Out of It Radio Network. Hear all our great shows across the world. Join our community at snapoutofitradionetwork.com. So wake up, stand up, and snap out of it. Just imagine how it would feel to live the life you desire, a life of meaning, purpose, and passion. Watch the life of your dreams unfold as a whole new world of possibilities await you. Just imagine that. And now, the host of Just Imagine That, Scotty Johnson.
And welcome to all of our listeners. Good morning, wherever you or afternoon, no matter where you are. We have a really exciting show today. And before we move on to our guest, I want to talk about what happened this past weekend. For those of you who listen regularly, I live in Portland, Oregon. And Abraham Hicks was here this past weekend, and I was privileged to attend the workshop. It was, as it always is, absolutely phenomenal. But Abraham said something repeatedly during the workshop that's really important, and we've talked about it here before this. You know, a lot of people will say, oh, the law of attraction doesn't work. I do my affirmations and my visualizations, but my stuff is not here. Where's my stuff? And the point that Abraham made is that we have all learned thought patterns that may not be terribly productive, and it takes practice to learn new ones. And I think what trips a lot of people up with the law of attraction is that they don't realize that it's a constant practice, and it has to become part of your daily routine. And it also requires you not just to visualize, but to really get in touch with the feelings that relate to that thing you want, no matter what it is. And for those of you who can possibly get the CDs, they were absolutely wonderful, and I would definitely recommend them. Having said that, we have a really exciting guest today, Suzanne Eder. And, you know, many of us have been inspired by spiritual teachers like Byron Katie and Eckhart Tolle, who experienced life-changing spiritual awakenings, and for them, virtually overnight. Their insights were deep, their teachings were inspiring, and yet the suddenness of their transformation sometimes leaves people feeling that they just can't get there from here. Is it possible to reach our highest potential and to live from the soul rather than the ego without undergoing that dramatic experience? Today, our guest, Suzanne Eder, is going to explore these concepts with us. And for those of you who do not know, her website is at www.mysolidground.com. Again, that's mysolidground, all one word, .com. And it's a terrific website. She's got her schedule, she's got her books, just it's a wonderful read, so please everybody go visit it. And we're also going to be talking about her book, 10 Ways to Peace Versus Panic. And Suzanne, thank you so much for joining us here today. Welcome.
Thank you, Scotty. I really am delighted to be here. I've been looking forward to this ever since we had it scheduled.
Wonderful. Well, we feel the same way. So let's dig into your book, and then later in the show, I'd love to talk with you about the law of attraction, because I know you have some really good thoughts on that as well.
Absolutely. Would love to do that.
Okay. Well, in going through your book, the very first thing you do is tell people to make friends with fear. And on the surface, Suzanne, that seems like kind of an odd concept. Why do you think it's important?
It does seem like kind of an odd concept, but the point is that most of us, when we feel fear, either try to cover it up, we just try to pretend it doesn't exist, or we cave into it. And neither one of those strategies is particularly effective, especially when you do consider the law of attraction, right? So there's this vibrational, there's this there's this experience that we're having, this feeling state that's fear. And if we give in to it, now we've just expanded that. If we try to cover it up but don't really face it, then we're just doing what I call putting a paste over on. And now we're sending out mixed signals. We have fear vibrating. We have this other thing we're trying to focus on. So what I have found is that if we can instead face the fear, don't cave into it, don't turn away from it, we have an opportunity then for actual healing, because the fear is coming from some kind of a false belief about who we are. And we need to really get clear about what that is so we can challenge it and heal it. And then we can bring in our powerful affirmations, our visualizations, and they can actually get some traction, because there won't be this fear base that we're trying to cover up.
Right, right. Because sweeping it under the rug is not going to change your vibrational status.
Not at all. Not at all. And, you know, in the fear, too, I like to think of it from its most, you know, from a tender place. You know, let's face it, fear is a reflection of our feeling very vulnerable. And so what we don't want to do is trivialize that or again, cave into it. So we want to treat it the way we would treat, say, a frightened child. You know, this is just a misunderstanding. We're not remembering something about who we really are and what's really possible for our lives. So we want to treat fear with tenderness, but with firmness. And again, try to get to the root of what is it that we're actually believing to be true. Are we believing ourselves to be not good enough? Are we believing ourselves, to be worthless? Are we believing ourselves to be invisible? And there's something underneath the feeling of fear that we need to really, really address. And that's where healing happens.
Right. And do you have exercises that you recommend for your clients to make friends with fear?
I do. One of my favorite ones, I'm a big fan of writing in journals, so I encourage people to, you know, pick up a pen, get the journal out, and at first give voice to the fear. Let it say what it has to say. Just get it all out. Get everything out. It's really a way of witnessing a part of ourselves rather than shutting it down. So you get all that stuff out on paper. And now, you know, one of the advantages that has just all by itself is once we've written it down, it sort of has mobilized, it sort of has, we get it away from us rather than it being spinning around in our heads or clutching at our throats. It's now on a piece of paper where we can gain some perspective on it. And then I encourage people to do one of two things, and possibly both, depending on what they've written and how they've written it. One is to literally go through everything that fear has said and challenge it. Statement by statement, is this really true? Like, really bring to bear, your kind, rational self. Is this really true? Is it possible it's not true? So really kind of dig into it rather than being just making the assumption that what you've written is true, because that's what gives fear its power, right? We believe it's true. So once you've written down these things, then you can actually challenge them one by one. Another wonderful thing to do is then to step back, take some really nice deep breaths, drop into the deepest center of your being, and call up the wisest, kindest, most loving persona you can. Actually, it's not a persona, it's your deepest self. And then give the pen to that part of you and let that part of you respond. Really connect with your deepest wisdom, your highest knowing. And write to yourself from that place. You know, dear Scott, you have totally misunderstood. It couldn't possibly be true that this thing that you want to do couldn't be a success. But you know for sure that you're wanted. You know for sure that you have what it takes. So just really speaking to yourself from that place of great love and great support. Because we have to, as you said at the beginning, what we have to actually do is practice speaking to and about ourselves in the most affirming, validating, respectful way. Because many of us have gotten into the habit of a sort of self-talk that's very diminishing and very demeaning and very critical. So we really need to cultivate this other voice, this voice of truth, this voice that has our best interests at heart. And that takes practice.
Right. And there are two things that I'd love to talk to you about. First of all, there are some people who say, journaling doesn't work for me. It's just not a fit, and I don't find that it helps. For those people who just are not journalers, what would you recommend?
You know, you're right, that does come up quite a bit. Well, I have two thoughts that come to mind. One is, you know, not to be obstinate, but I have found that the people most resistant to journaling, if they actually give it a try, come to love it. They come to love it, and they're surprised. So it may just be that they sit there with an open journal and don't know where to start. So when I'm working with a client, I tell them what to, you know, I give them the questions. I give them the, here's what you start with. Answer these questions, write about this. And that usually helps people get over that hump. But, you know, if not, if they just simply don't feel at all drawn to it, it just, you know, it feels fake, it, you know, it just feels superficial, then of course you don't want to try to force yourself. So in that case, I would really, really then encourage them to at least be willing to monitor their inner dialogue, to spend time every day in contemplation and meditation, and throughout the day to take some pauses and say, okay, how am I talking to myself right now? Especially if they're feeling stressed. If they're, you know, as soon as they start to feel any physical sensation of distress or tightness or discomfort, to check in, what am I thinking right now? So get in the habit, and this, by the way, I suggest whether you're journaling or not, but especially if you're not journaling, to really hold an intention to listen in, to witness your thoughts so that you can be more clear about which direction they're headed.
Okay. And it, going way back to when you were talking about the journaling, you said something that is so critical. You said that look at those, the things that you've written down, the statements, and ask if they are true, because we often assume they are. And a lot of people get tripped up with false assumptions that they don't even recognize they hold.
Exactly. Exactly. You're so right about that.
Right.
And,
right.
And sometimes it's, yeah, I mean, they're, like, here's a, you know, a common example, one that I use in the book is, you know, someone's upset, why are you upset? I just got laid off. And the truth is that getting laid off isn't what's upsetting them. It's what they're making that mean. It's what they're interpreting that to mean.
Mm-hmm.
It means I'll never find another job again. It means they didn't appreciate me. It means, you know, so there's a whole story about what this event means. That's what's upsetting them. But that's the thing that we have complete control over, is our interpretation.
Exactly, because I lost my job or I just got laid off, in and of itself, is simply a neutral statement of fact. It's all the baggage that people put on it that creates the negativity and the fear.
Exactly, exactly. And again, this, to shift that takes practice. It takes an actual, you know, kind of a concerted effort. You know, we have to really be aware, first of all, that what's causing the stress isn't the event. It's how I'm holding it. It's how I'm relating to it. And then really be willing to create a whole new story, to create a whole new interpretation, to focus our attention where we want to go rather than where we've been. So it really does take some practice. And that's why I am,
absolutely,
you know, that's why I've become a, you know, I'm not only a coach myself, but I'm a client of a coach. I really believe in this process because, you know, we're just not meant to do this alone.
Right. And you know, it's so funny you would use that particular phrase, because you can take that same phrase, I got laid off from my job, and say, isn't that wonderful? I get unemployment for a year, and I've got time to figure out what I really want to do. And in fact, one of our earlier guests handled it exactly that way, and the universe just laid out a complete financial support and a pathway that brought him joy.
Yes, yes, yes. You know, even before I was kind of consciously committed to this path that I'm on, when I was still in the corporate world, I witnessed many, many, many layoffs. And, you know, there was always a lot of high drama around them and a lot of upset, understandably. Not trying to minimize that in any way. But what I observed, though, was that more times than not, the people who got laid off were far happier. You know, it actually did create, you know, it created this huge opening for them, this, you know, this huge opportunity to recreate their lives. And if they stepped into that opportunity, then they did, you know, then they were really much more fulfilled.
Right. Once you get over the initial shock, because I'm sure it is, but if you can find a way to say, what if it's the best thing that ever happened to me, and just play with a phrase like that, it can take on a whole new perspective.
Yes. Yes, that's absolutely right. And that's probably, that's part of the art of this, too, is learning to talk to yourself, to ask yourself the right kinds of questions, not, oh, why did this happen to me? But how might this serve me? You know, to really keep turning your questions around in a way that opens up possibility.
Right. And very often we are not trained to think in that way. We've been trained to buy into the party line, I was laid off, oh, I'm a failure, oh, this is awful. We probably grew up with those kinds of concepts being handed to us, and we just put them in our suitcase, and off we went.
And off we went. Yet that whole, it's that reflection of this sense that we're all separate, that we're living in a, you know, a scarce universe with limited resources, and that that power is outside of us. It, you know, our happiness is dependent on what other people say or do or don't do. And that's a very disempowered state. So what we're talking about is reclaiming that inner power, that inner connection to source, to divine intelligence, to life itself, and starting from that place.
Right. Oh, and by the way, Suzanne, for your next book, for those people who have trouble journaling, you need to put your sample questions into the book to help people learn how to journal.
How to journal, yeah. Yes, that's a great idea. I do a journaling workshop periodically for that reason, and people have really liked it.
Yeah, that's a great idea. Now, you recommended something in the book that I found fascinating. You said to turn off your TV. Why?
Well, in most cases, and I realize that I'm making a generalization, but I think it's mostly true. You know, what is on TV is coming from a level of consciousness, a mindset that is that wants to inflame our fear, that wants to create alarm. It's, you know, it's all about crisis and what's going wrong, and you know, it's all about conflict and debate and right versus wrong, and it's very inflammatory in many cases, or very depressing. And you know, as I say in the book, I think we have a real responsibility to actually nourish our minds, nourish our souls with things that are going to feed us. Things are going to move us in the direction that we want to go. And so I think that most people, when they see a particularly depressing newscast, that leaves them literally paralyzed or depressed or furious. But none of those states are empowered. They're not places where we can take really empowered action. And again, back to the law of attraction, if I'm taking in all of these thoughts, these fear-based thoughts, without my conscious intervention, that's where my thoughts are going to go. They're going to be entrained into that. So I'm going to be sitting there, you know, awash in fear and negativity, you know. So to me, it's easier just to turn it off. And I don't mean to imply that we stick our heads in the sand, but just that we be really mindful and use our powers of discernment to choose what and whom we're listening to.
Well, you know, Suzanne, in journalism, people who study journalism are told if it bleeds, it leads.
Yes.
So it's just openly known that it's supposed to be depressing and antagonistic and crisis-oriented. But, you know, it's funny. When you talk about putting your head in the sand, I haven't watched TV in probably 5 years. And still, if there's information I need to know about, somehow it gets back to me.
Absolutely. That's something I also observed in the book, that truly, if you're living true to who you are and what you're here to give and to do and to create, you will come into contact with the information that you need. It just, that's just the way it works. So right. it does require a certain clarity about who am I and what am I here, you know, what am I called to, you know, what fascinates me, what calls me, what am I here to create, to give, to experience. And as long as we stay true to that, of course, we'll find the resources, the information, the people that we need.
Well, and think about it. Even some of the very neutral information that's on the news, like when they broadcast traffic reports every day, if you funnel that through the law of attraction, if you show people traffic jams, they're going to expect traffic jams, and they're going to end up in traffic jams.
Right. You're exactly. And again, from the place that I always come back to is that this point that you were making, that this is our we're trained that right now the dominant, and I hope this is changing consciousness, comes from a paradigm of separateness, of conflict, of competition, of scarcity. And so that's the very consciousness that we're seeking to shift in order to really experience an abundant life. And so even if, as you say, there's something that is apparently neutral, it's coming from an underlying mindset of something's going to go wrong. Something always goes wrong. You better watch out. This doesn't go wrong. So there's this continual focus on, you know, having to protect yourself, having to get your share, having to watch out, so it's coming from that fear-based place. And we simply can't live an inspired life from that place.
No, not at all. And you know, that ties into something that you had talked about in the book that was, for me, a very powerful statement, that energy follows attention.
Yes. Yes. Energy follows.
Could you talk about that a little bit?
Sure. So, first of all, you know, I think we've established, you know, by our talking about the law of attraction, that we are living in an energetic universe, that the fundamental nature of everything is energetic, it's vibrational. And so what calls a particular vibration into our experience is our attention to it. Our attention is actually a creative force. Because by attending to it, we are resonating with it. So that's why all these things that we're talking about actually work the way they work, because if we're giving our attention to, in this recent example, negative programming on television, then the energy, our energy, the energy of our lives is going to follow that. It's going to follow that negativity, because that's what energy does. Like energy attracts, and it is our paying attention to something that activates the vibration. Does that make sense?
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. You know, and part of that involves judgment and that self-talk. Like, going back to the traffic jam, why is a traffic jam bad? What if you're stuck in traffic and you end up listening to this really inspirational one-hour CD because you're sitting there anyway, and maybe you wouldn't have listened to all of it if you had been moving more quickly? So much of it seems to me, is if you can shift that attention, you can also shift your energy.
Absolutely. And I think the piece you're getting at now is a related concept around releasing resistance. Because what we normally do when something doesn't appear to be going the way we think it should is we judge it. It shouldn't be this way. I shouldn't be in this traffic jam. It shouldn't be happening. But it is happening. And so the more we push against it, again, that's where we're placing our energy. We're actually holding it into place. You know, what you've heard that phrase many times, what we resist persists. So a lot of the opportunity for ushering in freshness and creativity and inspiration is just to practice releasing resistance to what is in this moment, and then consciously focusing our attention on what is good, what is serving us, what opportunities are being created, just like an example that you gave. If I'm stuck in a traffic jam, I can ask, how might this be serving me? What does this open up for me right now? And maybe it's just the opportunity to practice patience. You know, maybe it's just I get to practice my deep breathing. I get to practice being at peace no matter what. Or as you said, maybe, I can put that CD in I've been meaning to listen to. So just really holding this intention to release that resistance and open ourselves to new possibilities.
Right, right. And that's key. If you can release that resistance and that soften tied to the fear, and you used the dreaded S word, should.
Yes.
If we could eliminate the word should from our vocabulary, that would go a long way.
I know. Yes, indeed. I mean, sometimes it can be used in a way that really does mean I want to. This is what feels right for me to do. But oftentimes the should is, as you know, it's just a judgment. It's just a self-judgment. And it's always defeating and depleting. So I always encourage my clients to drop that word. It's always a red flag.
Now, in your book, you talked about getting grounded. And when you say grounded, what do you mean?
Well, in the book, I actually was talking about this paradox of kind of surrendering to the groundlessness of it all, that there isn't a fixed particular way things have to be in order for us to be happy. That's sort of what gets us hung up. So like when I get laid off, oh my gosh, I needed that job to make me happy. The idea in the book was to say, let's just acknowledge that there is nothing really solid in the eternal sense of the word. Let's surrender to the fact that we're living in this endlessly abundant, ever-changing, energetic, vibrational, cyclical universe where nothing is fixed, nothing is solid. There's actually great freedom and security in that. So rather than attaching to, things have to be this particular way in order for me to be okay, it's like, no, let's get grounded in the deeper truth that things are never a particular way. They're always in motion. There's always a creative opportunity. So it's getting grounded in the groundless, I called it. Now, the other way I often use the term getting grounded is to get grounded here on planet Earth. You know, a lot of us on the spiritual path can get pretty excited about a lot of ideas and, you know, visualizations and all kinds of, you know, fabulous things of the mind. But where we have the opportunity is to get grounded, to get connected to the energies of this Earth where we can manifest.
Right. And you know, in the same chapter, you made a statement that I absolutely love, that all of us have the full creative power of the universe at our disposal. It's out there for everybody.
Yes. It's actually in here. You know, when you really, really sit with, oh, my gosh, there is no separation. The full creative power of the universe is in and all around me. It isn't. I'm not separate from it at all. It animates mm-hmm. my very being. So it's in me. It's all around me, and it's limitless.
And when, I mean, that is so powerful. But the hard part is how do you counsel people to be able to maintain that perspective? And let's just say, more often than not.
Yeah, that's a great question. And at the risk of sounding really, really repetitive, the word comes back to practice. But actually, what I always say to people is this kind of a transformational shift in perspective that you and I are talking about, it requires four elements: intention, awareness, willingness, and practice. So we need to first and foremost hold this intention, like make this inner declaration to ourselves, this is the perspective I want to live from within. This is what I know to be true. Don't always feel it, but this understanding that we do have the full creative power of the universe right here within us and all around us, that's the perspective I'm going to live from. So to really actually consciously declare that, so hold an intention for that to be so. And that can't be understated, or overstated, I should say, that the power of our intention around that. So really have that be a conscious kind of an inner declaration. And then the awareness piece is be willing then to notice all of what you think, how you react, what you say that doesn't come from that place. You know, what are the thoughts that I'm holding? What are the things I habitually say? What are the reactions I have to events that aren't coming from that place? You know, thoughts such as, oh, my God, that just was way too much work. I can never do that. Oh, she was born with, you know, all the thoughts that we have about why somebody else succeeds and we don't. Or, so you want to just look for, not with judgment, but with curiosity, all the ways that we're thinking, talking, and acting that are not in alignment with that deeper truth that we are limitless creative beings. So just, again, you know, calling on our awareness to kind of see where, you know, what's the dominant thought process that I'm holding right now. And then become willing to challenge it and change it, and then to practice challenging it and changing it. So, this comes back to what I think we had on the topic for today. It's called Everyday Enlightenment. You know, it's not as typical for someone to have this sudden, oh my God, I get it. I'm a fully divine being. I'm completely limitless, and that's it. I get it now. For most of us, it's this kind of incremental step-by-step process where we keep coming back to, this is the truth I want to live by. And every time we come back to it and reaffirm it, it becomes stronger. Now, we keep giving our attention to it. Even if our attention wanders, we keep bringing it back. Now, this is the perspective I want to hold. And, you know, again, start practicing thinking, speaking, acting in ways that are consistent with that deeper truth. And I think it's really important to have to find ways to stay supported and inspired, you know, to actively seek out people who share this point of view, to actively read the books that are inspiring, to actively join the groups that are pointing in the same direction. So to really make this a commitment and a priority to surround ourselves with the kind of people and ideas that are supportive of living from that truth.
Yes. And, you know, Suzanne, the example you gave was so powerful when you talked about, oh, well, she always succeeds, but she was born wealthy or smart
mm-hmm.
or whatever.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Those types of statements create an energetic loop in that if you are saying you give an excuse why she's succeeding and I'm not, what you're really focused on is, the I'm not succeeding. And so you're bringing more of that back to yourself. And don't you think if people understood the cost of those types of thoughts, they'd be eager to get rid of them?
Yes. Yes. Although I tell you what, what's often true is that people do understand and they feel like they can't get rid of them. I don't know if you've ever encountered that when in conversations with others, but sometimes I know people get frustrated. Oh, darn it, here's that thought again. You know, I want to be happy for her, but I just can't, you know. And well, and then what that triggers is yet another round of self-judgment. I should be able to get rid of this thought. So, you know. And so I look at this as a very artful process. We do need to become very aware of the relationship between those kinds of thoughts and our own energy. Like when I say that kind of a thing, oh, well, no wonder she's successful. She was born rich. Like to be really sensitive to, and how am I feeling when I say that? Am I feeling empowered? Am I feeling optimistic? Am I feeling inspired? The answer is no. So it really does take probably a certain amount of repetition for us to get really, really clear. Oh, my God, this very thought is diminishing me. This very thought is holding me back. It has nothing to do with her. It's my thought about her. But it takes a while to make that connection, to really feel that, you know, to really get it. Oh, my gosh, it's this thought that I keep holding. Then once you get it, then you really are motivated. Whoa, okay, now I really feel and sense the relationship between these habitual thoughts and what it's doing to my energy. And then we do become more willing to actually practice making the change, challenging the thought, bringing in new thoughts that align with our deeper truth.
Right, and often, I think we all have done this until we become committed to the practice. We didn't learn to tie our shoes or to walk or to drive by flipping a light switch. It was a little bit of learning at a time until it became mastery for us.
Yeah.
And sometimes do you find that people beat up on themselves because it's not happening like flipping a light switch?
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. I've done that myself, frankly. You know, I'll catch myself saying, Suzanne, you of all people, you teach this stuff. You know, that's my favorite inner critic line. You of all people. And yes, I see that so frequently with my clients. They just beat themselves up almost mercilessly when they're holding a vision for something and it just doesn't seem to be manifesting, you know, quickly enough. And this is where I think it really is. This is where, why we need to bring in our highest level of self-compassion and lightness and humor and playfulness, and also to be willing to see how even a delay might be serving us. It's usually giving us the opportunity to heal something, to heal this more deeply held fear that, oh, my God, I'm not good enough. I don't deserve this. Of course it's not going to happen, you know, because what usually happens when there's a delay, a seeming delay, we jump to conclusions about why that is so. And those very conclusions are what we're here to heal. So the delay itself provides the opportunity to become even clearer and more committed to the deeper truth of who we are and how worthy we are and how creative we are.
Right, right. And you know, you made a very powerful point in the book about the power of choice, that any of us can choose to connect with either inspiration or desperation. And how do you help your clients choose the inspiration?
Well, first, I think the very concept of choice around that is usually pretty illuminating, because I think many people sort of unconsciously believe that inspiration is something that just sort of happens. You know, you're just, oh, one day you feel inspired. So it seems almost, you know, random or capricious. And the idea that, no, we can choose to be inspired, like that idea all by itself is usually a pretty catalytic one. Like, oh, I get to choose how I feel. I get to choose a state of being that serves me. And then I simply, you know, have a conversation with them. Let's talk about what inspires you. Let's talk about who inspires. Let's talk about what kind of environment inspires. So really, it's actually fairly simple once you get the idea that it is a choice, that it is something you can cultivate, something you can practice, something you can choose to be. Not that it's always easy to get there, but again, the idea is to really shift that perspective from one of, oh, I have to wait for some external event to inspire me, to, oh, I can take ownership of that. I can choose how I want to be and seek inspiration.
And do you have any techniques or practices that you recommend to people for learning to choose or to seek that inspiration?
There's nothing that I routinely would suggest. It really is very specific to the person. So, you know, it's what I normally do is simply engage in a dialogue around it. Let's see if we can uncover together how that might look for you, how that might work for you. Let's talk about when you felt inspired in the past. Let's talk about what inspires you right now. Let's talk about how you can expose yourself to that more often. And of course, one of the simplest things I do encourage people to do is to use a contemplative practice, a meditative practice, to sit, to call into their mind, their heart, an experience, a memory, anything that has inspired them, or perhaps an idea they have for a project, or something that really does call forth within them a feeling of inspiration, and practice holding that. So it really does make the point that inspiration can be self-generated. It really doesn't depend on there being a specific external event. It depends on our being willing to place our attention, you know, to kind of consciously conjure up and really feel it. So use your meditation time to call up and to experience being inspired. And again, that shifts your vibration, and, you know, then you can practice. Then it does become, you know, of course, the classic complaint is, I feel great in a meditation, then I step outside and get in a traffic jam, right? And it all goes away. But so you just notice that, and you keep coming back to, so how might I shift my state of being right now? So it really does become an ongoing practice. But I think it's really important to do that, that particular one where we just sit. We literally self-generate a feeling of inspiration.
Wonderful. Now, what is the difference? You talk about this in the book, between security and predictability.
Yeah, isn't that a great one? I think security is that's something we all have to define for ourselves. But I think what we have often done as a culture is we have equated the two. We've said that as long as I have a predictable something, you know, salary, you know, predictable bonuses, you know, predictable, I know when the bills are coming in. A lot of it has to do with financial predictability. That we have equated that with being secure. And so when that's threatened, then of course we feel very insecure. But I'm suggesting, and not certainly not only me, you know, many, many wise and wonderful teachers and leaders all around us have suggested that true security isn't ever found in any particular thing or even routine. It's found in this connection with Source. That's our true security, our deep grasp of who we really are, of ourselves as creative, eternal beings, always connected to Source. Because when we get that, then we understand that there's always more where that came from, you know, to use a much overused phrase. So, again, our security isn't about what happens on the outside. It's about the state of being that we're holding and the life that we're creating through this Source energy. That's our true security, our resilience, our creativity, our inspiration. Those are our sources of security because that's how we meet life's challenges. Predictability is, in many cases, what we've created out of fear. It's a fear-based structure, and what it often does is it imprisons our freer spirit and imprisons our soul, because our soul wants creative self-expression. It wants to experience, to create, to give, and predictability actually shuts that down. But in fear, we've equated predictability with security, so we've actually, diminished in many ways our true creative self-expression.
What's so funny? Predictability seems to be a double-edged sword for most people because they do want that certainty when it comes to their finances, but it's the last thing they want in terms of the way they want to spend their day.
Yes.
And this is what you're saying, you know, would I rather spend my day playing tennis, or would I rather be at my desk doing the same thing that I do all day long, every day? So it seems like a lot of people pick and choose where they want their predictability.
Yes. And I mean, let's face it, in the world of finances, you know, it is easier to manage bill payment and so forth when you have a somewhat predictable stream of income. But still, I think we do ourselves a disservice by equating that predictability of financial income with actual security. And where we have the opportunity for really growth is to see money as a form of energy like everything else, and to trust in the flow, to trust in our connection to Source, find our security there.
Right. Now, you had one chapter in the book that was really fascinating that you captioned telling the truth about your life. What do you mean when you say that?
What I meant by that in the book particularly was, because the book was framed around being in a period of uncertainty, being in a period of, I don't know what, you know, what's going on. I'm in the middle of some kind of a transition and I'm confused. So the tell the truth about your life is, let's just come clean with ourselves. Let's be honest about all the ways we may have been sacrificing things like our freedom for this predictability. Like, you know, where have I been out of alignment with myself, with my deepest longings, with my creative impulses? You know, there's so many ways we compromise, so many ways. We may have stayed in a job that we absolutely can't stand because we're afraid of not having the money. We may be in a relationship that's stultifying, and we've not yet learned to speak our truth. There may be things that we have been putting up with, living without, that don't honor who we truly are. And these times of transition are the perfect times to come clean about that. You know, how have I been living my life in a way that really doesn't fully reflect who I am?
Right.
And that's actually hard. That's kind of hard because you kind of cringe, like, oh gosh, yeah, you can. Because in many ways, in many times, we've done things for years that we can see. Oh my gosh, I just did that because I was afraid. I just did that because I was afraid they wouldn't like me. You know, and you see, you know, the price that you pay when you're not true to yourself.
Right, right. Or you know, all those excuses like I've got to stay at this job I hate because I have children to support.
Right. Yes. Yes. Exactly. That's a great example of telling the truth. So the truth is, I really do hate my job, and it's depleting me. And then to be willing to look at, what assumptions am I making? Am I making the assumption this is the only job I could ever find that would pay the kind of money I need? You know, really, what are the assumptions that you're making that are keeping you stuck?
Right. Not to mention, what am I teaching my my children?
Yeah.
Get up and go to a job you hate every day just because you have to support the kids?
Yeah, that's a surefire road to resentment.
Right, right. You use the phrase life amnesty, and can you tell us a little bit about that and what the benefit of that is?
That just kind of came to me as maybe a fun kind of metaphor for this idea that a lot of times we don't tell the truth about our lives because we're just afraid to. Like, we're afraid, like, oh, my God, what is this? You know, the fact that I've been keeping myself stuck in a really bad relationship with the fact that I've kept myself stuck in a really bad job, like, what does that mean about me, you know? And, you know, what I wanted to encourage people to do is don't be afraid. Don't be afraid of facing the truth. You know, it's like I was thinking of a tax amnesty. Like, if someone's been avoiding paying taxes, avoiding, for the, then there's a tax, you know, there's an amnesty. Just pay up and you don't have to pay a penalty, you know. It's that kind of a concept where if you just come clean, just be honest with yourself, there's no penalty. It's the honesty itself will free you. Because what we normally do when we actually face the truth is then we punish ourselves. Oh, my God, I can't believe I'm an idiot. I've been in this job for so long. So the telling the truth becomes another opportunity for self-judgment. And I'm saying, no, give yourself an amnesty here. Just come clean. Let the truth set you free. No penalty.
And in that regard, how do you advise people to learn how to discern what is listening to their true self versus wishful thinking or perhaps false assumptions? Is there a way to clearly tell the difference?
Boy, that is the $64,000 question. That probably is. No, really. I mean, this is something that I spend a lot of time on, both personally and with my clients, because I really, there really is, we all do have this inner wisdom, this sense of rightness for us. It's very difficult to discern, especially when there are things that we want, things we're resisting. You know, there's so many voices, so many thoughts and reactions that we're having at any one time. How do we know what is most deeply true and right? And, again, this is just one that requires an ongoing willingness to discern. I always encourage the place I start with people when I'm coaching them is to check their bodies, that when you're hearing something that's really true for you, it feels differently in your body. So, for example, there was a time in my own life when I decided to leave the corporate world, and I didn't have a ton of money in savings. It wasn't like I had made this plan that I was all financially ready to leave and support myself for 10 years while I built my business. But I got this, you know, I just wasn't in that position financially, but I got this very clear, this thought came into my head. It was actually in the middle of an exercise routine. So I was, you know, I hadn't been thinking or worrying. I was, you know, in the flow of exercise and music, and I paused, and this thought came in, now is the time to leave. meaning my job. Now is the time to leave. And Skagit was so crystal clear. It was just that single thought, very, very soft, very neutral, no fanfare, but I felt in my chest a sense of peace. And so I knew I could trust that. Now, in the very next, and by the way, I went ahead and resigned, and, you know, I acted on it immediately, and then I was like, oh, my God, what have I done? You know, all that. Then the fear came in, like that sense of peace didn't stay with me. But still, that's one of the ways that I help people find, you know, which of these many voices that you're listening to within in your mind and your heart, which are the ones that are holding your highest truth. And one of the ways is to listen, to really discern how does this feel in my body. When I was at the Barbara Brennan School of Healing, a lot of the healing work that we were trained to do, you know, really required that we be highly sensitive to our intuitive knowing. And they would always ask us, how do you know that you know? So you had to get really clear on your own personal inner signals. Ah, when my truth speaks to me, I feel this way. Something else that's kind of interesting about inner truth or inner guidance is it's never critical. So if it's like, you know, you better get off your, it never speaks that way, ever. So any voice that sounds like that is not your voice of truth or guidance. The guidance voice is usually very, almost neutral. It's not a lot of fanfare, but it usually feels a certain way in your body.
Right. And maybe encourage people, it seems like if they could think back to a time where they had that experience, to reconnect with that sense of relief. That's what I'm hearing from you. It's like a sense of relief when you finally connect with what you know is right.
It is, or I would say even, I actually use the word release because sometimes relief can be tricky. Relief can often be like if I've been worried about something and I just tell myself to stop worrying about it, okay, now I'm relieved. But I haven't really solved anything. So we want to find that inner sense of release, of spaciousness, of rightness. And you're right, I do often encourage people to think back towards some of the best decisions you've ever made, the ones that you just knew in your heart of hearts was right. How did that feel? So I do that. I do encourage people to kind of reconnect with times in their lives where they've really they've listened to the inner voice, they've recognized it, they've acted on it, and it was absolutely the right thing. And again, this takes, as with everything else, it just takes this willingness to keep practicing, to keep observing, to keep honoring it.
Right. And how do you recommend that people sustain that commitment to practice? And what do you tell them when they fall off the practice wagon?
Tell them to get back on. You know, it's this is why I love meditation, by the way. I always encourage people to take on several, at least one practice of self-connection, deep self-connection. And particularly what meditation trains us to do, as you know, is, you know, you start to get lost in your thoughts, and as soon as you realize, oh, I'm lost on my thought, I come back. It's just, you know, no fanfare, no judgment. Let me just come back. Let me come back to my breath or my mantra. So it's a really great practice in not becoming an alarmist, not making any drama out of anything. So if I drift out of these new habits I'm trying to create, new thought patterns, as soon as I'm aware that I've drifted, I'll just come back. Like, keep it real simple. Don't make a problem out of it. You know, much like if you've ever chosen to go on a diet or to adopt a healthy lifestyle in any way, you know, a classic that happens to people is they take all these great habits and they slip and they, you know, eat a whole bunch of French fries. And then what they do is like, oh, then they berate themselves. Oh, my God, I'm such a loser. And they just give up. Oh, forget it then. I don't have what it takes. And they're kind of just lost. It's a similar concept. So if you're holding this intention to really live true to your highest vision, to really be mindful of all the conditioned negative thoughts that have kept you stuck in the past, to be willing to really focus your attention in different ways, it does take practice. And if you slip off, if you revert back to old ways of thinking, as soon as you notice that you've done it, pause, pat yourself on the back for noticing, come on back. You just keep coming on back to where you want to be. And over time, it really does become easier. It becomes almost kind of funny when you you slip off, and, oh, there's that old thought again. Like, it used to be my self-doubt was just so incriminating and so believable, and I would listen to it and cave into it, and now when that voice comes, it's like, oh, there you are again. I'm not going to listen to you today. So, you know, the more you practice, you know, the less these negative thoughts have a hold on you. And you see them for
right.
what they are, just, you know, an old habit.
And toward the end of the book, you talked about following your longings. And what guidelines or practices do you recommend for people to find their true longing?
I think, you know, two things. There's no particular thing, again, whether the intention, but two things that I often encourage people to do. One is, first, to give themselves some time, like to actually carve some time and space into their lives to actually go deep and connect with themselves. Like, so many of us don't even ask that question. You know, we're just living our lives. We're going to the dentist. We're getting the kids to soccer practice. You know, it's activity, activity, activity. It's all on the surface, and we've not even given ourselves or the space to even ask the question, what am I deeply longing to experience in my life? And so just to make that a priority, it doesn't have to be gobs of time, but some regular amount of self-connection time where that is the intention to ask of ourselves. And I encourage people to do things like go to bookstores, you know, like browse. Notice as you go through your day, what excites you? What interests you? What calls you? What has a tingle for you? Just start noticing, you know, put on the lens of, I'm going to discover my longings. And so let that become your filter for observing your day. You know, how much of what I'm doing really does call to me? How much of what I'm doing really does align with who I am and what I'm longing for? So that's one method. Another is just, it's actually even simpler. It's just being willing to check in with yourself moment to moment. I don't mean every single 60 seconds, but throughout your day to pause and check in and ask, how am I feeling? What do I need? Because the more we check in, even at the simplest level, maybe, oh, you know, I'm hungry. Oh, I'd love to take a nap. Like, even at those simple, direct responses to how am I feeling? What do I need? If we follow them, if we honor them, they will lead us step by step to the deeper longings. You know, if we keep ignoring our most basic needs, we'll never get to the deeper ones. So that's another practice I really encourage people to do, is just to make it a habit, you know, as an act of self-care and self-love, and to carry out this intention of really living a more vibrant life, make a habit of checking in. How am I feeling in this moment? What do I need? And again, if you keep doing that and keep honoring that, it'll lead you step by step to those deeper longings.
And it doesn't sound like it's too terribly hard to do.
It really isn't. It's so much simpler than we think it is.
And what a great way to go through your day, instead of just being on autopilot and thinking no farther than, oh, I have to pick up the kids at 2.
Exactly. Yes, exactly.
So, Suzanne, we have like a minute left. If you had some words of wisdom that you consider more important than any other, what would you tell our listeners?
I really most want people to know is that they matter. Their longings matter, and it's really possible to live a life where your longings lead. They lead you to your highest fulfillment and your highest contribution. You just have to honor them.
Thank you so much, Suzanne. This has just been a delight. I'm sure our audience got a tremendous amount out of hearing you today. I want to encourage everyone, please go to Suzanne's website, which is
mysolidground.com,
and you can learn more about her workshops. Be sure to get her book. It's really terrific. It's a wonderful little handbook for life, and you will thoroughly enjoy it. Suzanne, thank you so much for being with us here today.
Thank you, Scott. It's been such a pleasure.
And please, to all of our listeners, tune in. Join us next week. We have a fascinating guest, Joan King, who has written The Code of Authentic Living. Fascinating lady who started out in her early years in a convent and then left, went on to get her PhD in neuroscience and psychology. She is now a coach and consultant after having been a professor at Tufts University for 20 years. She melds her scientific background with spirituality, so it's going to be a really informative session. And for all of you who were with us here today, thank you so much for tuning in, and join us next week.